The Mac Observer's Mac Geek App, episode 536 for Sunday, January 18th, 2015.
And welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where the tea is hot today. Holy cow, that tea is hot. I went with hot tea for the show and sipped it during the intro, and it got me. This is the show where you send in your questions about Apple stuff. You send in tips. You send in your cool stuff found about tech stuff in general, really. And we share it all. We talk about it. We try to answer your questions. And all together, the goal is to learn lots of new things each and every time we get together. Our sponsor for this episode is Barebones Software at barebones.com, makers of BB Edit and Yojimbo. We'll talk about those later on in the show here in Durham, New Hampshire. I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here in icy, rainy, it's a mess out here, man. Fairfield, Connecticut. This is John F. Braun.
Yeah, man. My commute to the TMO Towers East here was treacherous today. So much so that I thought we were going to have to cancel the show, but I made it.
Your commute?
What's that? How many feet? It's about 70 across the driveway, I think, is what we've counted. Maybe less.
You got skates in the house. Couldn't you have gotten the skates out?
Dude, you haven't seen me on skates. I played pond hockey as a kid, but I'm not so good on skates these days. But today, the skates probably would have been the safest way to get from the house to the office. It was pretty bad out there. But thankfully, we don't have to drive. So that's a good thing. Hopefully, nobody out there that's listening live at MacGeekGab.com/stream had to drive or has to drive anywhere if you are in an area like the Northeast where it's just spitting ice and the temperature is like 25 degrees. It's not good. It's not good, but that's okay. John, I do have an announcement to make, though. This is likely the last week that we'll be recording Mac Geek Gab on the computer that I have in front of me.
I was going to say, newsflash, huh?
So
we're retiring?
No. Yeah. We're retiring something.
We're good news.
I think so. So, you know, when I had those problems with the iMac down in the office, I started thinking, okay, well, you know, it is out of warranty. It's past its 3 years. So, you know, maybe it's time to get some new blood in the system here, and start passing things around. And specifically, I started thinking about this computer up here in the studio, which CPU wise is, I mean, it's the way Apple has written Core Audio makes it such that we need more CPU than we have up here. We didn't 7 years ago, you know, when we put this computer into service here, but that's a long time for the computer to be doing anything, even though it's doing exactly the same thing we wanted it to do 7 years ago. The OS has changed. So we need more CPU. It's just the way it works. And so I figured, well, when Retina iMacs go on the refurb store and they come down a little bit, then maybe I'll buy one of those for my desk and I'll roll the 27-inch, you know, 2011 i7 iMac up here. And so they did. They went on the refurb store on Friday. I don't know if they're still there. We will link to it, of course. And that plus some help from a friend on the inside with a little bit of extra discount got me I honestly forget what I paid for it off the top of my head, but I got the obviously 27-inch 5K Retina iMac coming to the office with the 4 gigahertz i7, the 512 gig SSD, and 16 gigs of RAM. And it should be here tomorrow. So probably by the next time we record this show, I will have, you know, rolled everything around and should be recording on the quote unquote old 27 up here. So I'm looking forward to that. It should be a fine machine. I'm looking forward to the Retina display. It will be my first computer with a Retina display, but not my first device.
Right. Because that would be your iPhone.
iPad. Right. Correct.
So I kind of had a disaster, Dave.
Can I
tell you about my disaster? I want to tell you about the disaster.
Go.
I fixed the disaster. So some of you may have seen. So I actually was, twittering about something that I revisited because there was a good reason I revisited it. And it's something called Backup Loop. And this is one of several tools that will let you look at what is in your Time Machine backup. Now, why was I doing that, you may ask? Well, the reason is because I just recently made a change to my new refurb here. And then I'm like, you know what? Everything's working great. So you know what I should do? I should install Yosemite Server. Right. It's like, John, don't you know better? Everything's working. So why are you screwing things up?
Right.
Well, if it ain't broke, running server,
fix it till it is.
So the thing is, I added Yosemite Server. You know, you can get it if you're part of the dev program, or you can, I think right now, purchase it for, $20, which, to me, for all that it offers is a pretty reasonable price. Then I started noticing, and that's why I got Backup Loop. Then I started noticing that my Time Machine backups were getting rather large. Like they were saving like on the order of like many tens of gigabytes per backup that I use another tool that has been, updated as of late, Time Machine Editor. But I noticed that at every backup, Dave, it would say that it's backing up tens of gigabytes. I'm like, what is going on? And I finally found out what was going on. What was going on once I ran Backup Loop, which basically takes your Time Machine backups and lets you index them and shows you what is being backed up for each backup, and also shows you the size of them. Well, for some bizarre reason, Dave, apparently Yosemite Server has a little bug, which I know is a shocker for people that are running Yosemite that there are any bugs.
Yeah. Uh-oh, call Marco.
Here's what was happening.
Yeah.
So once I ran this tool, it was showing me that there was literally hundreds of gigabytes being backed up from library server wiki. I'm like, I'm not even running that. But apparently it's a known bug in that for whatever reason, it goes out of control and creates hundreds of gigabytes of backup files. Because all of a sudden I looked at my SSD and it was like, dude, you have like 300 gigs free. I'm like, wait a second. I got a 1 terabyte SSD and all of a sudden I got 300 free. Who's taking all this space? Well, it was a Yosemite Server. The wiki component was kind of going out of control. So, So by using this tool, I was able to find where all this, what was being backed up, and was able to basically whack it and, get it in the right state here. But, Backup Loop, I think, is great. Someone actually, said, well, it's kind of sad that you need a tool like that. And it's like, well, it depends on why you're running it. And if you all of a sudden notice that your Time Machine backups are, taking tens of gigabytes per backup when they shouldn't be, well, this will tell you why. So,
yeah, exactly.
So I was able to solve that and actually free up. Again, it was like hundreds of gigs were being taken up by this thing that was just out of control.
Nice. So, that's awesome, man. That's good.
Yeah.
All right. Let's let Rob start things here. Rob is actually an old friend of mine, actually the brother of a friend of mine that I knew growing up, and Facebook reconnected us several months ago. And he says, I'm writing to ask your opinion on my MacBook Air. I spilled coffee near it, which made its way inside through a back vent. The Wi-Fi stopped working a day later. I'm able to use Thunderbolt to access the internet with Gigabit E, making the device stationary. The Apple Store wants $750 to send it out for cleaning. Personally, I think I could remove the bottom while inverted and clean it myself. My question is whether there is some structural trick built in that would cause me to damage the device and its innards just by opening it. So we've talked about a lot of this, but it's good to wrap all of this up into, kind of one problem-oriented bundle. Opening any Mac is not inherently difficult. It takes patience. And it used to be, of course, that the hard part was you didn't know what to do, right? But because Apple didn't and still doesn't publish an instruction manual that you and I typically get access to in order to open these things up. But the good news is we have the folks at iFixit and others, but iFixit is always the first place I go. OWC's videos are good, though. To find a manual for opening something up. So with those instructions, you can open up a laptop. As you and I both know, John, I always like to say laptops are like onions, right? They're built in layers. That's true of iMacs now, too. Whereas, you know, no matter where you want to get, you might have to pull off three things to get there and do it safely and properly. But with patience, you can get there. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. So that would be one thing. With Apple, though, you know, to hear about a $750 repair for a laptop is a little puzzling when, but it might make sense, but it's a little puzzling when we know that for $349 usually, there is the possibility of what Apple calls flat rate repair. And that's where you send it off to, the Genius Bar doesn't do flat rate repair. You send it off it used to be Austin. I don't know where it is now. But you send it off to an Apple facility and they go through everything and fix everything that's wrong with it. It's essentially a warranty tune up, but you're out of warranty. So you're paying $350. So I would try that. Now, because it was coffee damage, that might be the reason that flat rate repair did not come up in your conversation at the Genius Bar. They can take a computer in for flat rate and then send it out. But you might have better luck just calling AppleCare, you know, the 800-275-2273 number and see if you can get that person to agree to take it under flat rate repair. And if you do, they'll send you a box. So that's my feeling, but you could open it up. I don't know that opening it up. I don't know what I would do in that situation if it was coffee damage. Coffee can be, it's a good cleanser depending on how strong it was, right? So this may be irreparable harm, at least in terms of what you or I could do in our homes to repair it. But I don't know. It's hard to say.
Well, especially depending on what you have in your coffee, I would say that coffee without any adulterants is probably the least harmful.
Yeah, it's acidic,
once
right?
Once you start adding milk or sugar, then you get sugar and electronics don't really, in theory, pure water shouldn't hurt anything, but you're hardly ever going to get pure water, even your water.
Right. Right. Sure. It's got stuff in it, minerals that makes it conductive and all that.
But,
kind of stuff.
Yeah. But I had one too, where I actually had, it made me very sad because it was one of my favorite beers that I dumped, quite a bit of in one of my machines. And of course, beer has alcohol, which is basically sugar. And yeah, it got all sticky. It was a disaster.
Huh?
So if you're going to spill something in your computer,
if you just poured isopropyl alcohol in your computer, that wouldn't be bad, though. No, I don't think the alcohol was your problem. I think it's the sugarized yeast and or not yeast, but hops and all of that stuff. That's probably more of the issue in beer. Yeah.
Yeah, because once it dried and all that, everything was sticky and
sticky. Alcohol by itself will just evaporate. That's not so much a problem. Right. Yeah. But if the alcohol is the vessel and it brings all this other crap in there and then it evaporates, now you've got all that crap stuck and that sucks.
Yeah.
So that I would investigate flat rate repair because my guess, Rob, is that there is some electronic damage that has already happened that has rendered your Wi-Fi useless. And, if you want to take it apart, take it apart. There's nothing wrong with it. It's fun. I guess that's your thing. Want to take us to Kaz, John? Rock the Kaz bra is what I'm going to say to you. All right, go.
And actually, someone in our room pointed out that alcohol is not sugar, but the body metabolizes it.
There you go.
Yes, good point.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. It's not a computer is not usually a biological system, right? It's not a carbon-based life form, so it's not going to convert that into sugar. That's true.
Right.
That's true.
So Kaz has a good question, and I think I had a good answer. And then we'll color the answer.
Sure.
So Kaz says, hello, Dave and John. Happy New Year. I was listening to episode 531 when you mentioned that it's possible to capture YouTube videos using DigiDNA. I didn't know this was possible.
Amazing, right? Just to get the name right.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Right.
Wait, no, that's the wrong. DigiDNA makes iMazing, but DigiDNA doesn't let you capture YouTube videos. That's somebody else. Mac XDVD.
I'm reading and not.
Right. I'm trying to correct on the fly. I think it's Mac XDVD YouTube downloader, YouTube video downloader. We'll put a link to it in the show notes just to get it right. And that way we didn't screw things up. So go ahead. Sorry.
Right.
Yeah.
But it led Kaz to say, well, there's something I wanted to do in that vein. And Kaz subscribes and views several sites where they stream video tutorials, mostly about Photoshop and other photography related videos. Often there's a small segment of that video that has the specific information that I want to keep for later reference. My current workflow is to have a Word document open while viewing the tutorial, and I write down the timestamp of the specific segment I want to reference for later viewing. It would be awesome if I could instead capture the actual video and save that as my reference. I know it's probably illegal.
Probably. Sure. Yeah. Safe bet.
You may be bending the rules here.
Correct.
But I feel that if I'm paying for the video tutorial, I should be able to capture those parts that are important to me, much like burning digital copies of movies I have bought and own.
Can I just step in there and talk as someone who is not even close to innocent on this particular subject in a general sense? But you have every right to whatever you have purchased. And if what you have purchased is a, you know, lifetime license to that, like if you bought the DVD or something, absolutely. But if what you have purchased is a subscription for a month at a time, then once that subscription goes away, in theory, you should throw away whatever videos you create with the methods that we're about to tell you how to do. In theory. Now, again, you know, do as I say, not as I do. But I'm actually pretty good about that.
Okay, so what I did today, which is I used Handbrake to rip a DVD that I had not yet watched that I borrowed from the library and then returned it today because it was due today. So that technically was probably naughty, right?
Yeah, that's right.
It worked great, though.
I know. I've done it, too. Like I said, I mean, you know, it's hard not to just use technology to make our lives more convenient. And in a case like what you did right there, you know, did you hurt anybody by doing that? No, you actually helped because now somebody else could rent that movie. But there's a license issue, right? So I don't know. It's hard to say. It's far worse if you take that video and give it to me. Right. That's seriously.
Again, for person, and as we said, personal consumption. The thing is, I just didn't get around to it. And the thing is, you can't renew certain titles, and this was one of them. They call it Express.
Sure.
So I'm like, okay, I didn't get around to it. I, you know, don't want to go through the hokey pokey of returning it and then checking it out again, which I guess I technically could have done. I'm just gonna save it and watch it at my leisure.
Yeah,
leisure.
All right, tangentially speaking, there's a video playing in your web browser, and you want to record a snippet of that.
Right.
Right.
Now, how can you do this? Is basically what Kaz was saying. How can I do that?
Is there a camera on my iPhone
out there? You know, there's something even better, Dave.
Oh, good.
And, you know, it gets even better than that because we've all seen cheesy videos of you taking a video or anybody taking a video of a video. It's just not.
It's not good. Yeah.
And my answer to Kaz was as follows, and then we have a follow-up. So believe it or not, there is a basic screen recording application built right in OS X, Dave. Did you know this?
I did.
You did, but Kaz,
I forgot.
Think did.
I knew it as soon as you told me. I was like, oh yeah, I knew that, but I never would have thought of it.
So here's what you do.
Yeah.
So launch QuickTime Player by whatever means necessary. Then click on the done button because what it's going to start off with is saying, hey, would you like to load something? And I guess the answer is done because you don't want to open a video. Then what you do is you go to file, and there's going to be a choice, new screen recording. You choose that, and then it says, okay, well, you know, here's what you want to do if you want to go full screen or you want to limit the area to record. Here's how to stop the recording, and that's pretty much it. Once you start, anything on your screen will be recorded in a happy little QuickTime movie. It doesn't capture the... So it's not a true full-featured capture in that the audio is... It will offer... It's like, hey, but by the way, you know, what audio channel would you like to capture? And your options are built-in mic or line-in. So it's not going to capture the audio of the but it sounds like for what Kaz wants to do, I think this will work.
That might
it's capturing the video.
Yeah, but, I mean,
and
it
maybe
would capture
he wants
the
to even annotate it. He may even want to annotate it on his own.
Sure.
In which case, choosing built-in microphone for the annotation on the video may actually work better for him.
So here's something you could do, though. It will record the audio. It'll just record
it. I know what you're going to say.
Through the microphone coming from the speakers, right? So you've got the ambience of your room, which, like you said, in Kaz's case, might actually be a good thing because the ambience includes Kaz's voice. Or you could get a mini eighth cable and to mini eighth and just like hit, which is headphone to headphone, and just plug it in from your output to your input. If your Mac has separate output and input, jacks, which not all Macs do. Some Macs have a combined jack, and then it's not going to work for you. But anyway, there you go. Or yeah, no, that's all you can do.
Yeah. All right. A couple of things. So one, we just got something from our chat room here saying that Firefox apparently offers better video capture options than other browsers. So that's another suggestion.
Well, there. Just to save, it depends. So what Mac Tech Freak is saying in the room is in Firefox, right click on the video in a new window, choose media, then scroll, find the video file and save it. That can work depending on how that video is being streamed to you, though. It's not necessarily a guarantee that that will work that way.
Right. And then the follow-up. Shall I do the follow-up, Dave?
Yeah.
I think you had some commentary. So I
sure. Well, there's some better apps to do this with, better apps than QuickTime Player that will record the system audio and give you a whole lot more control over, you know, how you're recording and what you're recording. Yeah.
All right. So one that I offer, just because I use it on both my machines and it works for me, but there is a piece of software from our friends at Ambrosia called Snaps Pro 10.
But we don't recommend you buy it. We can't
at this point because it's dated. I would say they haven't done any major. I use it because I bought it and it does my picture capture and my movie capture when I need to do it. And it does a fine job. But yeah, as you're saying, Dave, you know, it hasn't been updated for over a year. And whether it's going to be updated again at all is questionable. I mean, it works fine on both my machines here, both my sure. Yosemite machine and my Mavericks machine. But, I mean, there's a free trial. Try it.
If yeah,
it,
that's
if it
true.
Does what you need, hey, you know, go for it. They have a free trial, like, you know, any yeah, I think any good software company. And, you know, maybe it'll do it for you. But again, warning, it's not the latest. And you pointed that out when I said that to him. I'm like, well, I use this. But now yeah. Your choice. Dave, well, for doing screen or video capture.
I've been using ScreenFlow, and that works really well. It allows so much customization. You actually record the whole screen and you can record your voice as a separate voiceover track and mix it all together. You can then use crop tools on the video you recorded and say, okay, I only want this part of the screen. And you can do all sorts of expansion and zooming and all sorts of great stuff. It's not cheap. It's about $100, but I don't know what Snaps Pro 10 would sell for. Again, Snaps Pro 10 being a year and a half old, it works great at the moment. No indication of what's going to happen in the futures, but I think it's quite a bit cheaper, right? I think it's less than $50.
I thought it was like $70.
Oh, is it really?
The level of the program that you get.
Yeah. Okay. So, ScreenFlow is $99, works great. I've been really happy with it. It makes things so much easier, than I've ever had before. I also know that Camtasia for Mac is an option too. And quite a few people like that. And I've actually had some folks tell me they prefer that over ScreenFlow. So we'll put both of those in the show notes. I feel like I'm missing something though. And, that there's something kind of in the middle there price wise that will do this for you. But I just off the top of my head, I just can't think of it. So hopefully somebody in the chat room will come up with it before the show ends. Otherwise, if there's something that comes up, we'll of course add it and mention it in next week's show. Cause that's how we roll.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think Kaz right now is, weighing his options.
There you go.
And,
perfect.
All right. What comes after Kaz, Dave?
Yeah. We have, an interesting question from Wilco, but I actually want to take a moment here first and talk about our sponsor for the show, and that is Barebones Software at barebones.com, and very specifically their BB Edit. BB Edit 11 is the 11th major version release of one of the my favorite programs on the Mac. And I know it seems crazy to get excited about a text editor, and I have no trouble doing so because I could live without BB Edit, but the world would be a worse place for it. Certainly my world would be. It is one of the first apps I put on any Mac that I use. I use it throughout the day. Some days I use it all day long. I compose in it. I write articles because it's just great. It's a text interface. I can put HTML in if I want. And when I do, it's got all these shortcuts and it highlights the text and it just makes that easier. I always can see my word count right there on the screen. It saves as normal text files, so I don't have any weird formatting issues no matter what I'm doing with it. If I am editing something, like if you have your own website, like a Dreamhost website or something, and you want to edit manually what you do is you download the files, edit them on your computer, and then upload them. And you'd use FTP to do that uploading and downloading because that's how that works. Well, that's fine. And BB Edit lets you do that. They've got an FTP client built right in, and it basically takes the place of and looks just like the open and save dialogues that you'd have. So once you get a document open, if it's opened over FTP and you want to, you make some changes and you want to upload it, what do? You hit save, Command S, and it uploads it because that's saving back to the server. So it really does some cool stuff. It keeps local backups. In BB Edit 11, they added new syntax coloring. And one of my favorite things is they changed the user interface for finding changes between two versions of a document. So if you've got two versions of a document, you open them both. And actually you don't even have to open them both first. You can kind of point now and it makes it much more smooth and fluid. And now it's in one interface where you see one window where you see both documents and you can scroll through. And when you scroll through one, the other scrolls too. And you can click on the list of changes and see what's there. It's really, really smooth. And I use that quite a bit. It's a really handy feature. So you got to check it out. And that's the best part is you can go check it out for free at barebones.com. And once you've got it, it's $50. Once you're hooked, which won't take long if you're like me and use it all day, $50. So there you go. That's BB Edit from Bare Bones Software at barebones.com. And tell them we sent you. Tell them we said hi and tell them thanks for being sponsors of this show. We really appreciate it. All right, John. Now, Wilco. He says, I would like to combine a cool thing found with a question. Oh, we'll talk about his cool thing found another time. He says, the question is, I'm working on polishing my backup strategy, and a recommendation I read somewhere is to include the library folder of a user as well. When I configured my backup to add the library, the scanning of the folder took an awful lot of time, like 30 or 40 minutes compared to a typical under a minute for other folders. What I found is that most of the time was spent in the home library containers folders. If I understand this correctly, every subfolder in there has aliases to the user's data folder and the data subfolder. Typically for my situation, there's a subfolder for Lightroom that contains the actual database, or Lightroom, which has a humongous number of subfolders. My question, is it safe to leave out all of these data subfolders in containers? So containers, this is a great question. Containers are the OS X sandbox. And the way Apple kind of did this to make it work, most applications are going to look in your user folder, and inside your user folder, you expect to see documents, you expect to see desktop, and you also expect to see library. And then inside library, you might have application support where an application can go dump its own files. You might have in the preferences folder, an application might want to dump preferences in there. When sandboxing came around, the idea was, well, apps shouldn't be able to see each other's data, hence the term sandbox. You play in your sandbox, I play in mine, and we ne'er shall meet. But they had to recreate what that looks like to the applications. And so inside this home library containers folder, you can go see there'll be folders in there for each app. And when you go into those, each of them looks kind of like a fresh copy of your home folder. And some of the things actually point to, as Wilco alluded, point to other things in your home folder. And that's great because, again, it gives these apps what they're expecting to see without letting them touch each other's data, and especially without letting them touch each other's preferences and things like that. But that's a problem when you have a piece of third-party backup software, and I'm not sure what software Wilco's using here. If it's not programmed to be aware of how the library folder works, especially the containers folder, it will see multiple copies of your data and potentially will just keep backing them up. So yeah, in this instance, but I don't think there's a one size fits all answer here. You clearly know what you're doing. You know why you're seeing this, Wilco. You completely understand what's going on. My advice to you is yes, omit the data folder for the ones that are in there, but it's going to require some management. You're going to have to go in as you add new apps and tweak the way you've got that set, because there might be some apps that don't just point to whatever your copy is. They might have to create their own data folder inside containers. And then you do want to back that up. So you're going to have to create rules and exceptions. It's just how it's going to work. Right?
Yep.
All right. Any thoughts on that, John?
No, I told you my thoughts regarding backup before.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough.
Yeah, sometimes you got to do, well, like I said, yeah, you may have to get a tool that shows you what the heck is your backup programming backing up.
Yeah, well, it sounds like he figured that out, and it's not good.
Right? Yeah.
Yep. All right. Andy writes, this is a question near and dear to my heart, or at least near and dear to my office. I have a 2011 27-inch iMac with the stock 1 terabyte hard drive. The system has been problem-free since 2011, although I've added more RAM, and it works fine. The hard drive also seems to run fine, although its boot ups have been reduced to, much slower than I would like. My plan is to add a 512 gig or 1 terabyte SSD to act as the system drive, transfer everything that I need to that drive, and then nuke and pave the main hard drive for backup or data storage. My inquiry thus is twofold. Number one, what makes the most sense hardware cost risk-wise? There are, of course, many options. I could do a one-to-one swap and just take the hard drive out and put an SSD in. I could have dual internal drives, which, yes, you can, with an asterisk, or replace the optical drive. But I'd like to hear your thoughts. I'm pretty handy, but I've yet to crack this iMac open. Number two, more puzzlingly, what's the best way to make sure I get all and only the stuff I need to the new system drive? I made a bootable flash drive with the OS, but migration assistance seems too vague for everything else. I'd prefer to move only the software and data I want. Okay. So, yeah, migrating, this is interesting because I have, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, I have a 2011 iMac. Now, when I ordered it, this was pre-Fusion Drive days, and my machine remains pre-Fusion Drive, but it has both an SSD, a 256 gig SSD, and a 1 terabyte spindle in there. So there is room in your 2011 iMac for an SSD to be mounted in there. The issue is that adding an SSD to a machine that didn't come configured with one typically means that you don't have the mounting points under the optical drive to do that. You can look online, and some crafty individuals have actually used stick-on Velcro to do this. And SSD drives, for those of you that haven't handled them, are extremely light. I think you mentioned that in the last show, John, that you felt like, what is this thing I'm holding? It feels like a cracker, you know? So holding it up with Velcro is fine. I mean, you got to be a little concerned about heat melting the Velcro glue. The optical drive, it might get hot if you use a lot, but the SSD very, very well might get hot. But other than that, that tends to work for people. Replacing the hard drive or the optical drive that are in there, and by putting the SSD in place of them, would probably be the most robust way of doing it and getting the SSD internal. If it were me, I would do the Velcro thing if I were going to crack it open. But because that way you get everything, optical hard drive and SSD. But the thing is, every one of those requires opening up that machine, and more specifically, closing it. And more specifically, getting dust off of the inside of a 27-inch diagonal piece of glass and the outside of a 27-inch diagonal piece of glass that is the screen simultaneously, and then getting the cover back on. This is a trick. You're probably going to want to buy one of those silicone roller things that I mentioned that Apple told me about. But even still, this is not an easy thing. You will not get all the dust off. Apple doesn't even get all the dust off. The good news is, even when you know there's dust in there, you can't see it. The screen that is in front of me right now, I know has dust that I left in there, and I'm looking for it and can't find it. that it is, you know, there is a risk when you open up the computer, right? I would actually consider an external drive in this case. And the reason is you have a ton of options with that. You know, you've got Thunderbolt or USB 3, but you'd have to do USB 3 via Thunderbolt because the 2011 iMac doesn't have USB 3. It's only got USB 2. But you could get one of those little, you know, what is it? It's a $70 or $80 adapter from Kinex that gives you a Thunderbolt to USB 3 sort of mini dock, if you will. And it works, you know, that would work well for you. You might just want to go with a Thunderbolt drive to do that. They have enclosures that are, you know, that have both Thunderbolt and USB 3, for example, like the, you know, Buffalo's got one, Seagate's got one, LaCie's got their rugged drives that do that. But I would definitely consider going external in this case. I don't see, it's not like your computer's going to move around a lot. It's a 27 inch iMac, right? You're not putting it in your backpack and taking it to school. So I think going external here solves a lot of problems, and it also solves that. Well, it is a 3-year-old machine. Yes, I'm adding a, you know, 512 gig SSD to it. What if I want to migrate that? What if the machine dies in a month and I want to take this SSD and migrate it somewhere else? You know, you've got it. That's easy to do at that point. So I would go external. And you know what I'd do, John? I'll turn this into a mini review, although it's a pretty easy thing. I got the chance to check out the new OWC. I've got one of the new OWC Thunderbolt docks, the Thunderbolt 2 dock that they just came out with.
Yeah, I saw that. Oh, yeah, it looks pretty sweet.
Dude, this is the thing, right? And it's not, you know, it's not cheap. It's the right price. I think it's $249 if you pre-order it now, which makes it, especially now compared to kind of all the Thunderbolt 1 docks that we talked about over the summer, makes it the most expensive of those. But here's what you get. You get two Thunderbolt 2 boards, so it can do pass-through. One goes to the computer, one goes to whatever you want it to go to. HDMI, gigabit Ethernet, FireWire 800, audio in and out, and five, count them, five USB 3 ports on this thing, two of which automatically have 2.1 amp charging on them. This thing's killer. It's the dock to beat all docks. And it really takes a computer and it, like the 2011 iMac, and totally advances it into, you know, today's world. Five USB 3 ports, friggin' awesome. So you could hang a Thunderbolt drive off of this, although you wouldn't get this just to hang a Thunderbolt drive because you've already got Thunderbolt in the computer. You've got two ports on that one. But for USB 3, this is killer. If all you need it for is a single drive, it's too much. But you probably will wind up using it for other things. And really, for a laptop owner, this is killer, right? You plug in, you've got monitor and everything else. I love it. I think it's a fantastic thing. So there's your options. But I would definitely go external. I'd probably go USB 3 because you don't need to buy a drive. If you're going to get a Thunderbolt dock anyway, I'd go USB 3. If you're not, then I would get a drive that does Thunderbolt. You're going to be buying a Thunderbolt port one way or another here, just to get the speed you want out of that SSD. So that's my thoughts.
Dave, I have a final thought.
Go.
We kind of totally blew past this, and
sure,
I blame you.
As well, you should.
But I blame myself a bit because, you know, we're talking about the latest technology, and of course, you know, being geeks here, you know, part of our job is to keep up with the latest technology. But to me, I saw a question buried in this cry for help.
Yeah, go.
My system's slowing down. I have a rotational hard drive. How could I possibly make this better in the short term? I'm going to offer a solution, and I think you know what I'm going to say, Dave.
Yeah.
But I'm going to tell you. The problem is rotational hard drives suffer from a phenomenon that SSDs do not, call fragmentation.
Yep.
And that the more you use them, because they're kind of like, think about a rotational hard drive as kind of like a record player.
Well, what?
A record player.
Office last week.
You know, and that's the funny thing. What's old is new. So Dave is getting retro and has a so for those that aren't familiar with the technology, and then I'll try to bring us back on track here. A record is an analog audio storage device. right?
Yeah.
Vinyl.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
It's an analog audio storage device, and then you use this thing called a record player that has a needle that then pulls the data, and it's all analog. It's pretty happening, and it
yeah,
can
sort of. Sounds like
and
crap.
It can. Well, you know, it depends.
Yeah.
It depends on the quality of the recording and the quality of the needle and your turntable.
Right.
But the
right.
thing is,
it can
you're
sound
thinking
good.
About a rotational hard drive. The thing is that there is something called the head,
which is like a needle.
Which is like a needle that reads from, and it is like a record. It's a platter. And the problem is it has to move back and forth and back and forth and back and forth to read data. Now, when your drive is fresh and new, the data will get laid out in a sensible way, in that if you write a file, it will get laid out in areas that are contiguous. And so when you write them and you read them again, it's going to happen as fast as it can. But as time moves on, because the drive and the operating system, but I would guess the operating system really, for the most part, unless, you know, you are a OS wizard, doesn't really think about efficiency as far as where it lays the data out. It's like, I'm just going to lay it out wherever.
No, that's not true.
Well, I'm sorry. No, Apple and others have included, I think, some operating systems include technology that will try to put everything in a place where the data is reduces the possibility that the head is going to be. The problem is if the head of your hard drive, like the needle of a record player, has to jump all over the place, that's going to make your system sluggish.
Right.
So no, you're correct.
Let me try and encapsulate this. So if you have a file that is small and it only takes up one chunk of the drive, that's easy, right? The needle goes, the head goes, reads the one chunk for the file, and that's it. Everything on the hard drive is in chunks or blocks. Well, if you have a large file and it takes up five blocks, and five might not actually be that large, but for the sake of argument, it takes up five blocks. If the drive is relatively free, when the system writes that file out, it's going to put all five of those blocks connected to each other right together. So the head goes to the beginning one, drives along all five, reads the file. No problem. The problem is that John's pointing out that does happen over time is we put stuff on our drives, we take it off, we create weird little holes of data all over the drive. And so it might be that we don't have five blocks next to each other. In fact, we've only got two next to each other and then three scattered elsewhere. So now the head is jumping all over the place to get this one file. And that is what you're hearing when you hear the drive grinding and all that stuff. That's what's going on, is the head is jumping all around and it makes reading files slow. So how do you solve this problem, John? I've got data scattered all over the drive. It's not organized anymore. How do I reorganize?
Well, you know, it would be great if somebody wrote some software that could do something called. So I'm going to call what you just said, Dave, fragmentation.
Yeah.
And that data is scattered about. Wouldn't it be great if somebody wrote some software that does something called defragmentation? And off the top of my head, Dave, you and I both know that our friends at ProSoft, a component of Drive Genius is a defragmentation operation, which basically I think what it does is, now my only concern is, you know, for a while I was nervous about defragmentation software because the problem is if it gets interrupted or something terrible happens, like the power goes out and so what it does is it basically rearranges all of the data on your drive so that it is in nice little contiguous blocks. And with a mechanical drive or a rotational drive, that is the best scenario because the head doesn't have to jump all over the place. That my only caution is, oh my goodness, make a backup. Because the thing is, if that process gets interrupted, you could have a wonky drive.
So here's the thing, though.
Is that the technical term?
It is.
The thing is,
no, it's totally.
You could experience if something bad happens during the process, you could have a drive that is then
forked.
A brick.
Yeah, that's right. So here's the thing, though. OS X does do some defragmentation internally, as we mentioned. OS X calls it hot files management, and it does. It tries to identify smaller files that are used frequently, and it puts them at the beginning. This is very similar, but not nearly the same in purpose as the Fusion drive, right? Where you've got an SSD and a spindle drive married together as one volume, and it tries to store things that you need access to quickly.
Are they smart about what they put on the SSD?
Oh, yeah.
With the goal of being to make your experiences.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's good. That's the whole point. Nice. Yeah. No, it's good. Right. It still scares the heck out of me, but whatever. It's good. And
well, it's a mystery as to how it does what it does.
It's not a mystery, but it's
or why it does what it does.
Yeah, it's
maybe
it repairing it. It gets difficult. That's what scares me about it. Is it's very difficult to repair. In fact, most of the time, you just have to say there's no repair. You know, restore from a backup kind of thing. And that's the part that, you know, as the geek in me, say, whoa, spend a little bit more money and get an SSD that's big enough, and you're good. But anyway, which is what I did with my new iMac. Almost bought the 1 terabyte SSD and then just couldn't convince myself that it was worth it. I'm sure I'm wrong. No, I was
from
really close.
From Apple.
But yeah, the built-in, right. I got the built-in 512. No, pricing was fine. Pricing wasn't the issue. It just was, is it worth spending money on a 1 terabyte SSD for a machine? I know I can have, and I realize now we're on yet another tangent of our tangent, but I can... I currently have a 256 gig SSD that everything boots from, all my documents are on, all my apps are on, and I have like 50 gigs free. So, going up to 512 will buy me some room that I don't know if I need, but I'll go there anyway. But I certainly there was just no reason for me to go all the way up to 1 terabyte on a fixed placement machine.
Very, very interesting to hear you say that, Dave.
Yeah, because I can attach
experiences.
I can attach drives.
You can never have too much SSD or RAM. But it sounds like you made the decision that maybe you can.
Yeah, well, no, you totally can. Too. Yeah, no, I think 256 is what most people need. I really do.
For an SSD?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, I violently disagree.
I know.
No.
No, I know.
Well, because I have my Mac Mini and I'm running out, I'm reaching the limits.
Well, it's a management headache, which is what the Fusion Drive actually solves.
Yes.
Right. That's the point. Okay. So, but anyway, you know, I think to get back here and wrap this all up for Andy, I don't think this is a good idea. Yes, you can defragment a drive. And listen, if you're in this scenario where you have a spindle drive that's slowed down, it's absolutely worth doing a backup of it and defragmenting it. But I think there's a law of diminishing returns on it. And this, now I'm going to get into my crazy crackpot theories. Remember, I don't necessarily believe in every conspiracy theory, but I emotionally support all of them. I believe in this one, although I have no facts to back it up whatsoever. But my theory is that Apple has put less and less effort, especially with Mavericks and Yosemite, into optimizing the OS for spindle drives. I don't think they test it on spindle drives anymore. I don't think anybody cares about how it runs on spindle drives anymore. SSD is the way of the world at Apple. And what we've seen, again, it started with Mavericks and it certainly carries through to Yosemite, perhaps even worse, is that these OSs just don't run well on a spindle drive. They run much better on an SSD. And I can speak to that on a machine that came with a spindle drive and worked great with, like, whatever it was, Leopard or whatever we get. Maybe it was before that, Tiger, right? And then as we got to like Mavericks, it's like, no, this thing's just not going to function. And I put an SSD in and the world, you know, opened up and it was fine. Other than the core audio CPU thing, we're past that now. The money's already been spent. The computer's coming, right? So I think the path you're heading down, Andy, adding the SSD is the right path for the future for you, for the present and for the future. And it's, again, based on one of my totally crackpot theories, but I don't think I'm a crackpot on this one. On this one, I don't think I'm a crackpot. I'll submit that I'm a crackpot, just not on this one.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm with you.
Yeah, I know. And there's no argument coming in, folks. You. Okay. Let's see. David wrote in MacGeekab 535, He says, I was surprised to find that you discussed in your last podcast the very issue I was having problems with earlier this week, i.e. the inability to empty some trash items deleted from an external drive. After unsuccessfully spending a day trying to remove 5 files and a folder from the trash on my 27-inch Yosemite running iMac, I listened to your show and I tried the suggestions you had as well as some others. Everything I tried was... doing the change flags, no, you change command you mentioned, using trash it. I used the command sudo rmrf trashes. I killed the processes dedicated to crash plan, thinking that might be locking the files. I did all the easy stuff like booting in safe mode and doing all the above, plus, you know, the option key and emptying trash. Finally, none of those worked, by the way.
Wow.
Finally, yeah, I know. Finally, he says, just,
I mean, 3 is a charm, but this is 5 and it still didn't work.
That's right.
I'm baffled.
He says,
what?
Finally, just for grins, I ran Disk Utility and verified the disk only to find that the disk needed to be repaired. I ran the repair function and immediately afterwards, the files disappeared from the trash without any intervention on my part. Thought I'd pass this on to you as another option in case your listeners are still having trouble after trying all of the above. This is great advice, because everything we talk about here, well, not everything, but a lot of what we do here, we assume that your file system is intact, right? I mean, certainly for, you know, for answering that question, we could probably go back through the last, you know, 10 years of shows, how many times we've suggested, hey, wait a minute, you might have a file system problem, as opposed to trying to solve it with some, you know, very esoteric and problem specific solution. It's very easy for us geeks to jump straight into problem specific solutions, as opposed to saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, how is the system's overall health? And it's a good thing. In fact, as soon as I got his email, I went and verified all my disks on my machine, because you forget, it's easy to forget about. And it's important to do this. You know, I put this on the, you should do it every 3 months, so make sure you do it every 6 months kind of thing with your Mac, making sure to do a verify and repair of the disk, and just sort of, you know, let everything do the safe mode thing. Booting in safe mode once every, you know, 3 months, not a bad idea. Cleans out some caches. You know, it's kind of like a Onyx Lite, if you will, but it does a lot of the same stuff. So yeah, that's good stuff, David. Thanks for the intentional note and the unintentional reminder that we need to do this sort of maintenance on our machines on a regular basis. Thoughts on that, John? You don't do the maintenance.
I wish you didn't have. Well, you know, I gotta say, honestly, sometimes it gets to a point where how much maintenance should your average Joe or Jane or Jack or whatever your name is.
Yeah, that's a good question.
How much of this stuff should, you know,
can I answer the question
sometimes?
Because I think I actually have an answer. I know you're being rhetorical.
Well, no, because I'm thinking of people like, for example, my mom, which I've helped with. So she actually had a printer meltdown. And actually, I got to say, Mom, you did a great job, though she doesn't listen, as far as I know, to the podcast. But Mom had the thing is, oh my gosh, dude, if it wasn't for TeamViewer, I think I'd be a lot more upset, because the thing is, you know, my mom, probably like your parents and like most parents, the thing is, they're of another age. And we, I try, you and I try our best, Dave, to speak normal.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Even when I think I'm speaking normal English, parents don't get it.
Sure.
Mom doesn't get it.
Sure.
You know, and I'm like, so, you know, as soon as she calls me with a computer problem, I'm like, start up TeamViewer.
Right.
Let me remotely come into your computer and let me see for myself what the problem is. But she had a problem with the printer. You know, she was like, oh, the printer's not working. You screwed something up the last time you connected my computer. I'm like, well, no, I didn't. She's I tell it to.
Go ahead.
Go.
No, I was going to get us back on track, but there's no point in that today. We're both guilty of this.
She's like, I tried to print with my printer and I told it to print and it printed 3 pages with nothing on them. And you did something to do that. And I'm like, well, no, I didn't. No, the computer is doing exactly, and the printer is doing exactly what it was being told. The problem is your printer's broken.
Oh,
and it was.
Yeah, sure.
What happened is her printer was shot. Yeah. And actually, I got to say, hats off to mom. She went to Staples. Hilarious story here. So she's like, but I have
this tangent of the tangent for those of you following along. Keep going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's like, but I have these ink cartridges that I bought for the old printer, which actually me and my sister bought for mom. You know, it was all in one. And, you know, it was great while it worked. But then all of a sudden it failed. I think the print head just totally rolled over and died. She's like, what about my old ink cartridges? I'm like, well, you know, were they HP? She's like, yeah. I'm like, oh, cool. So she went to Staples. As she walked into Staples, the alarms went off. Because she bought the mail order from HP and they hadn't deactivated the EAS tags. Isn't that hilarious?
That's crazy.
She's walking into a store and the theft alarm goes off.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. It's how it works.
So number one, she was able to return. And yeah, I think it was the Staples. Number one, she was able to return these cartridges unopened, HP branded, for more than I think she paid for them. It's like, go mom. And number two, they offered her she bought a new HP all-in-one and it works swimmingly. The only weird part is I had to reinstall the driver because whatever she did, I think she did an AirPrint driver install. So she got pretty far along, but it would only insist on printing in black and white. And I'm like, okay, let me log in. Let me check it out. And I think AirPrint, for whatever reason, the AirPrint driver for this printer just is dumb. So I'm like, no, let's hook it up via USB. And then everything was great. But it was just kind of a funny story.
That's funny. No, it's good. I like it. It's good. All right. So are we going to get back to our tangent of the tangent? How much maintenance should we do? How much maintenance should your mom do?
You know, the thing is, she's never done any maintenance.
Yeah, I'm sure my mom hasn't either. Right.
In that I don't expect an average user, unless the OS throws up a red flag saying something seriously wrong, I don't expect your average user, nor do I think we should, Dave, to run Onyx or Disutility or repair permissions or booting in safe mode. Now, because you're listening to this podcast, you know that these are good things to do on occasion to keep your system happier than it otherwise would be. And it kind of saddens me, Dave, as a and maybe you as a computer enthusiast, whether it be Windows or Mac or whatever,
sure,
that people have to dig. Then again, you know, if it wasn't for this problem, we wouldn't be have been doing this for over a decade.
That's true.
For almost a decade,
yeah, right? I guess so. Although you can't do this on iOS, and we certainly solve our share of iOS problems, right? And perhaps you should need to do this on iOS because there's no reason that the file system on iOS couldn't get corrupted too. And sometimes it does, and that's when you get stuck and you just have to do a total nuke and pave on iOS far more frequently than you would on your Mac. I to answer your question, as far as maintenance goes for the average user, and by average user, I don't actually mean average user. I mean the average person listening to this show who's comfortable enough to try something new. Backup every day. That's easy. And you'll thank yourself once, and that's all it takes to make it worth it. Every 3 months, do a safe boot and do a permissions repair, which actually happens as part of the safe boot, and a volume, you know, the disk repair. And that's it. That's all you need to do on a regular basis, I think. You can go nuts and do a lot more, and there's nothing wrong with that. But in terms of the baseline, backup every day, every 3 months, reboot in safe mode, permissions repair, and disk repair. And safe mode is simple. As soon as you hear the chime, hold down the shift key.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go.
Okay. Very good. And actually, mom did call me. She was like, John, I got this error message. I'm like, oh, thank you for, can you tell me what it says? And she was like, yeah, Time Machine said it hadn't backed up for 3 weeks. I'm like, okay. And we fixed it.
Yeah.
At the very least, run Time Machine. Okay. Whose question? What? Where? What? What's going on here, Dave?
All right. You want to take us to Brent? Yeah. Take us to Brent. Yeah.
All right. Now, Brent.
Brent. All right. You went through a long ordeal with Brent, but you got a nugget of advice out of it.
Here's the problem with Brent. So Brent wrote in and he said, you know, I'm just going to encapsulate what the deal is with Brent. is, so Brent started looking in the console. Now, if you don't know what the console is, I'm not sure if we should open Pandora's box here, Dave. See, the problem is, here's the problem with Brent. And no, Brent, I'm not saying you have a problem. Maybe you do. The thing is, Brent said,
welcome to the club. We've got
looking,
jackets.
I started looking in the console. And I started, so the console, for those that don't know. So if you, the console is, I would say, not really a user thing. It's more a developer thing, or it's more for people that really want to know, what the heck is my operating system doing? What is Mac OS X? And there's an equivalent on Windows and other operating systems where basically all these really and many of them unimportant things are logged. It's mostly for developers and, you know, people that develop the OS or applications. The thing is, you can open this thing called the console and look at the messages. And so Brent started looking in the console. And all I have to say, and I'm being serious here, is that it is like looking into the abyss. It will lead you to madness. Because the problem
That's
is
true.
You're going to see messages where you do not understand the context. You don't know why they are there. You don't know. And a lot of the messages are put there by developers either.
Sorry.
That was fun.
Yeah, you know.
I bet that was your phone, huh?
It was.
Nice ringtone.
No, that wasn't my
phone.
No, in fact, my phone's muted. That was an alarm. We don't have to pick up my son from Jazz Band. Jazz Band was canceled because, you know, the roads are icy death. So there you go. But
so I'm going to say is, to wrap it up, Brent saw some messages in the console and it had the word error in it. Okay, I understand why you're concerned. The thing is, all I'm going to say is the messages that he saw were the same things that I see. Now, he was like, well, I'm running a beta version of the OS and I see these messages. And is there anything wrong? And what should I do? And I'm like, dude, stop.
Yeah. You know, it was.
Don't look for problems. The thing is, I think he was, again, good intentions, but he was looking for problems. And the thing is, if you look for problems in the console, you will find them. And my advice to you is,
absolutely,
unless you have a specific issue, and the thing is, a lot of things in the console are preceded by the name of the process or the program that is generating them. So if you have a specific problem with Time Machine, which you should look for messages from Backup D, or and this is where we can help
mail or whatever, right? Yeah, you can filter them down. But maybe that's a good thing. Unless if you're looking for something in the console, always use the filter, right? And that'll keep you from being distracted by all the other weird esoteric messages that aren't relevant to the problem you're trying to solve. Is that good advice?
Right.
Maybe not.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So he saw MDS volume errors, and I'm like, I see them too. Don't worry.
Yeah. No, and it is good. When you see something like that, it is worth searching for it or asking us and getting some confirmation as to, okay, is this bad or is this normal? Because there's a lot of stuff in the console, you know, to restate what you just said, John, there's a lot of stuff that looks really bad. That's not bad at all. It just is the way a developer wanted to throw a message to themselves. That's what the console is. A lot of it is messages that developers leave for themselves, not for you.
What gets me sometimes, Dave, as a developer, I'll see things in the console that get me is that they are notes from operating system processes saying, don't use this anymore.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's deprecated. Don't use me.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
The problem is when I see those messages coming from the operating system that I'm currently using, I'm like, oh boy.
Yeah. Oh boy. Right. Right. Yeah. It's like, okay. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
All right. Are we untangented here?
I think I really like the way the show went. In terms of,
oh my God, what?
I know. We're crazy.
I was all ready for.
I'm telling
the next
you, man.
Page.
I know.
But we're done.
I know. Well, I like where we went. We went deep on sort of our reasons behind things and the why behind the geeks, what, if you will. And, right?
Where?
Huh? Hello?
Who? What? Who? Why? What? Where? I think that has...
Is this an Abbott and Costello skit?
That's funny. I don't know who's on first.
That's right.
And I think that may be part of the title for the episode.
That's right. Yeah. No, it's I liked this. This was good. Hopefully you liked it too. Good stuff. Every now and then we do a show that that's for
random
us.
Random chaos.
Well, yeah, but it's I think it's good. I think it's good. All right. We want to tell you how to get in touch with us, though. If you have your own random chaos,
Dave,
that you want to loop
Dave,
us
is there
in.
Something? I think there's something new. What are you? Oh, you are a social media maniac as of late. Because what did you just do, or we did? Well, you did it.
Sure.
What did you do, Dave? Why did
you
do this?
I created a make. Hello. I made a Mac Geek Gab Facebook group. And we've had our Facebook page there for a while. We've had our Google Plus profile. Plus, at Google Plus, we've had the Google Plus group, which does astoundingly well. You know, we're racing towards 1,000 participants, and a lot are active. It's crazy over there. But Facebook is like, what, 10, 15 times the size of Google Plus. It started to dawn on me that this is crazy that we don't also. So this is not going to replace the Google Plus group, but we don't also have a group over at Facebook. So I started one yesterday. So you can visit us there. I will make the URL macgeekgab.com/Facebook go straight to that group. Now, it's a public group, but the way Facebook groups work, you have to ask to join. Anyone in the group, including you, once you've been accepted, can allow other people into the group. And please do that. There's no reason to exclude anyone. If we've got problems with somebody, John and I we're admins, and actually we might start making some of you admins too. And well, you know, we can weed that out. But the door, it's arms wide open, right? You know, come on in, we'll give you a hug. You know, it's how it works. And the great part about the groups is the UI for them. It's better than the UI on our page in terms of being able to ask and answer questions. You specifically being able to ask and answer questions. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, no, arms wide open until you screw up. And
yeah, then you're out right away. That's right. One strike and you're out. No.
No, we'll give you 3 strikes.
We will. Yeah.
Baseball. Baseball been very, very good to me.
That's right. Yeah. So yeah, come join us there. I will do that as soon as we finish here. I will make that redirect happen. So, all right. So that's step one. What's step two? How else do they contact us, John? We have an email address.
We have a number of them, Dave. But I would say the my favorite, Dave, is feedback@macgeekgab.com.
No, John, it's I know we haven't quite been doing this 10 years, so it's feedback@macgeekgab.com.
And you know, my esteemed colleague here, he still screws it up because it's feedback@macgeekgab.com. But there's another option, right, Dave?
Well, yeah, what's the other option?
Well, I think it's premium@macgeekgab.com.
And it is.
How does this happen? Well, we do have this thing called a premium program, Dave, where you can basically give us some monetary incentive to get preferential treatment when we queue up your questions and answer them. Where can people go for that?
Yeah,
info?
MacGeekGab.com has all the information on premium, and really, it's set up for those of you that want to support us directly. And we do, like John said, for those of you that can and do. We have our premium at MacGeekGab.com email address where you know, that's we give priority to. We answer everything that comes in. We really do. We're obsessive and crazy.
And they're goodies.
But we really appreciate it. And yes, the goodies. My sincere apologies,
Dave,
here.
Dave, it's not your fault. I blame others.
Yeah. I'll take the blame. Right. It's the vendor that we've been working with for, we worked with them for 11 Cirque de Max and several things before that has really just flaked out on us. And so that's what's happened to the current premium gift. I've rejiggered things, and this week is the week we're going to focus on just getting somebody else to do it. So, yeah. Yeah.
So you will get your goods.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've
you
seen
will.
The goods.
Thank
and
you.
The, and the goods are good. If you're into consuming liquids.
That's right.
Is a message here.
That's right. Yeah. Oh, what else do we have, John?
talked about the Facebooks, G Plus, Twitters. Well, the Twitters, of course, because that's always, well, I like Twitter. You like Twitter.
I do.
But if you are on Twitter, there are a few things. So if you want to follow me, I am John F. Braun. You want to follow him, he's Dave Hamilton. That other guy who is piloting about is Pilot Pete. The podcast is Mac Observer, and the publication is... Oh, I'm sorry. Right. Yeah.
That's right.
The podcast is Mac Ecap, and the publication is Mac Observer, all at twitter.com/... what I just said.
And while you were saying that, I fixed the redirect. So MacEcap.com/Facebook goes to the group now. I want to thank Michael. I want to thank Michael Johnston. He's the host of the iOS show and GetAppler.com. He converts the show to AAC and adds all the chapters and everything like that for you and for us. So thank you so much, Michael. I really appreciate it. We all do. And I know Apple doesn't make it easy anymore, but your work is appreciated. Also, thanks to the folks at CacheFly, CacheFly.com. They provide all the bandwidth to get the show from us to you and everything. So great folks there. I do want to thank our sponsors, as I said during the show, barebones.com with BB Edit. Of course, the folks at smilesoftware.com, gazelle.com to sell and buy used iOS and Mac stuff, squarespace.com/MGG to create your own website, lynda.com, LYNDA.com/MGG for 10 free days, and the folks at Drobo and Connected Data, MGG 50 gets you $50 off. The Gen 3 Drobo. John, you started the show. Please, if you would, end it with some lasting, very specific, but yet general advice for everyone.
I think we're going to end it, especially in this day and age of rain and ice and all sorts of tragedies here. Really want to make sure that you absolutely do not get caught.
Made up.